This is The Gaggle with David Helfenbein.
This week on The Gaggle, we have on Lissa Muscatine. Lissa Muscatine is current co-owner of Politics and Prose Bookstore and a longtime speechwriter for Secretary Clinton. She also collaborated on Secretary Clinton's White House memoir. Lissa, it is a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for coming on to The Gaggle.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you, Dave.
Lissa, I'd like to first talk to you about owning a bookstore. What goes into owning a bookstore? What is a daily routine like, a weekly routine? What kind of books do you have in your bookstore? Talk a little bit what it's like.
Well, it's really fun, first and foremost. It's hard. There's a lot of romance associated to owning a bookstore, and everybody thinks they want to, you know, work in a bookstore and own a bookstore because it's appealing, you know, because books are great and people love books and you get all sorts of people in bookstores. But the reality is that it's very, very hard work. Most people don't realize that the price of books is set, unlike most other commodities. And so one of the reasons that bookstores make very small margins and profits is because they can't set the price of a book. It's set by publishers. And so it's a pretty tough business. You have to sell a lot to be able to turn a profit. And it's a, you know, notoriously low wage industry for that reason, much to my chagrin, because we, you know, always want to be able to pay our employees more. But most people do it as a labor of love. And so we get incredibly talented, wonderful people working in the store of all ages and all backgrounds, and who just share a passion for books. And so that's sort of the challenge of it. What makes it so much fun is that, and this is certainly true of our store, and I would say the best independent bookstores in the country, we really view our bookstore as a community gathering place, a kind of a marketplace of ideas, a forum for discussion. And we have about 60,000 books in the store. That would be about 35,000 titles, fiction, nonfiction, poetry, drama, everything. And what our signature is really, though, in addition to an incredibly well-curated inventory of books, is that we have tremendous author events. So we have about 500 author events a year in the bookstore and another 100 or more outside of the store at different venues. So we just get an incredible parade of the most interesting, compelling authors of the day coming through the store. Our events are always built around new books, books that are just out. And because we're in Washington, people tend to want to come to Washington if they're on a book tour. So we really, if anything, our problem is we have to turn away so many authors that we can't accommodate on the schedule, if you can believe that. But we have this incredible, interesting array of authors, and that brings in huge crowds from our community who want to hear these authors and have the opportunity to see them in person and listen to them and ask them questions. And so it really provides a wonderful forum for civic discourse, for the exchange of ideas, for intellectual, social, cultural, political ferment, all of which you know, we care very deeply about. So it's a lot of fun.
You may have already provided the answer to this, but how does a bookstore like yours survive in the age of Amazon?
Yeah, well, Amazon is, you know, is a disruptive industry. We happen to believe that they engage in certain kinds of business practices that we wish the Justice Department would look into a little more carefully. And not that they shouldn't be commended for what they do, which is to sell vast quantities of goods at very low prices. But some of their practices, we believe, are predatory and are designed to push smaller independent bricks and mortar businesses out of business. So what we have discovered and what other good independent bookstores have discovered is that what Amazon does not have that we have in spades and that makes us such a destination for our community is very deep community roots. On Amazon, you have an algorithm telling you what book you might like if you purchase such and such a book. We have actual expert booksellers who can engage you in a conversation, who can really try to understand your taste, who can show you the book, who can describe it in detail, who are really smart and thoughtful people. Amazon does not do that. Amazon does not provide authors live, 20 feet from you, with, you know, telling you what about their book or their ideas, a person that you can sit and ask a question of in a kind of forum for discourse. So Amazon, what Amazon does is it's essentially a search function. If you know what you want, you go, you click on it, you get it fast, and you get it cheap. But a bookstore is an experience. It's a real experience. It's a gathering place. People come in, they want to discover. They don't just want to search, they want to discover. And it's interesting and kind of wonderful how often we'll see people at the checkout counter, with a pile of books, and they'll say, oh, did you find everything that you were looking for? And the answer inevitably is, not only did I find what I was looking for, I found about 10 other things that I wasn't looking for, but I was just so happy to come across them that I'm now dying to read them. And so that possibility of discovery, that possibility of human interaction, that possibility of seeing authors and others in our community willing to exchange ideas with people is really what I think separates us in a very, very positive way from the online retailers. And by the way, I didn't mention, David, we also have a wide array of courses that we offer for people. We've owned the store for about 5 years, and I think in that time we've offered over 300 different courses, and it's an incredibly popular item for our customers, people who want, again, they want to read interesting books in the company of other people with teachers who are really smart and be able to have these sorts of discussions within their, in their own communities. And so all those kinds of things make for a profound kind of experience that too often is missing when people are on computers and digital devices all day long.
Whose idea was it to buy the bookstore, you or your husband?
It was definitely not mine, nor was it really my husband's at the beginning. He had been a journalist at the Washington Post for many years and had written several books, by the way, had his own author events at Politics and Prose. And the store had been in existence about 24 or 5 years, actually a little bit more than that, I guess, when we bought it. And it was very successful. It was sort of a cultural landmark in D.C., to be honest. And the testament to that is that when the announcement was made that it was going to be put up for sale, which was happening because the co-owners at that point were in their mid-70s and one of them had been diagnosed with terminal cancer, it was a front-page story in the Washington Post that Politics and Prose was going to be put up for sale. And we were just chagrined like everyone else at the thought of this bookstore possibly disappearing or falling into the wrong hands. And what happened was, over the next few months, some of my husband's friends sort of needled him to think about, throwing his hat in the ring to try to become the owner of the store. And he waited for several months, by which time they had actually closed the process for it was almost like an audition. They had everybody who was interested fill out, a 12 or 13 page memo, did not talk about price, but just talked about values and interest in books and that sort of stuff. And my husband, Brad, just said to the guy who was handling the sale, well, why don't you just let me fill out the application anyway, if you just closed it? And he said, okay, get the application in, within a week. And so he did. And that was in, I think, October or so of 2011. And, 2010. And, in December, he got a call saying he was one of 6 finalists, and there had been about 55 or 56 different individuals or groups that had applied to be considered to be the next donors. So then my husband just said, why don't you come with me to the interview? And I said, well, why don't you ask if that's okay? And I was still, by the way, rolling my eyes saying, oh, wait, you're going to own Politics and Prose. Sure, go ahead, go for it. And to make a long story short, I did go to the interview with him. It was really interesting and accomplished two things. One, it made us both realize that it would take two people to do it. And the second thing was that because two women had previously owned the store, they clearly were interested in at least maintaining some female presence in the ownership ranks of the store. So then months and months passed. As my husband said, several Middle East wars came and went during the sale process. And then ultimately we were actually shocked, but delighted to be picked as the next owners. So we assumed ownership in June of 2011.
Let's switch gears to speechwriting for a few minutes. What has speechwriting been like for you to write for Secretary Clinton? What is the process like? How does it work?
Well, I was the first speechwriter she'd ever had. And, by the way, the woman probably doesn't really need a speechwriter. She's got a tremendous command of language, very lively sense of language. She obviously is brilliant and has well-formed ideas. And yet, she's busy, right? So she was giving tons and tons of speeches, even as first lady. So I was hired to be a halftime speechwriter for President Clinton and halftime for for then First Lady Hillary Clinton, there had never been a designated speechwriter for a First Lady because there really hadn't been a need for one. And of course, she was taking on a major policy role, healthcare reform. So there was a decision to actually have somebody part-time designated to her. And I was thrilled to have that opportunity. And over a couple of years, it became clear that she really needed somebody full-time. And I actually, by then, really wanted to write for her, with all due respect to President Clinton, even more than I wanted to write for him. And largely just because I think she and I related to each other in a certain way that was almost unspoken. Whereas with the president, I had to, you know, I just didn't think it was as natural a kind of sense of language, development of an argument, I guess you might say. And with Hillary, it was, I don't know, weirdly sort of instant and very natural. And, you know, I can't tell you, I could never possibly sum up how much I learned from this experience. She's so smart. She's so thoughtful. She's incredibly generous in her ideas. She's incredibly generous in sharing credit. I once joked to her that I had never had an original idea that she hadn't already had. And she, you know, very kindly and unnecessarily said to me, oh, that's not true. I don't even know where my ideas start and your ideas come in and my ideas end or your ideas end. That was absolutely not true, but it was like the nicest possible thing to say. So, you know, she's very challenging in the best sense of the word, very demanding in the best sense of the word. She had very high standards. She obviously operates herself at an extremely high level intellectually. But there's a humanity to her, and I learned, you know, I learned a lot about her, about being a parent. I learned a lot from her, just watching the way she conducted herself in her life, in addition to the sheer brilliance of her mind and her ideas. So, you know, such a privilege, is all I can say.
Is there a particular speech that you can point to and say is one of the favorites that you have worked on?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I hate to have to hark back this far, given that I, you know, wrote for her for most of the White House years and then, you know, helped her on her memoir, as you mentioned, her White House memoir, and then wrote her Denver convention speech in 2008 and, you know, have helped along the way and, you know, also at stake for a couple of years. But for sure, my all-time favorite has to be her speech to the Fourth World Conference, the United Nations Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing in 1995. It was a really fraught situation politically and diplomatically, and many people, without going into all the details of the story, but there was a great very few people actually wanted her to go and address this UN gathering in China at that point. And it was very risky, and she was determined to do it because it was a conference on women, and she felt that she had you know, she was one of the most visible women in the world at that point, and she believed in using her platform and her voice on behalf of women and girls and their rights. And she knew she would draw a lot of attention if she went. Well, there was this whole controversy before she went that had to do with the Chinese arresting a guy and putting him in prison, and various people then thought she should not go because it would be condoning the Chinese on their, you know, human rights violations and so on. But in the end, the Chinese let the guy go. Probably realizing that their conference was going to be nothing if she didn't come. And they were trying very hard at that point to sort of emerge as a more important and influential player on the world stage. So they very much wanted to host the conference and be seen as a kind of legitimate, you know, country in the eyes of the rest of the world. And so we went, and, you know, she gave a blockbuster. I mean, I think it's routinely regarded as one of the top 100 speeches, you know, in all these lists of famous speeches. And it was just such an unequivocal, unwavering, unambiguous, what's the word? I'm a speechwriter and I'm speechless. But, you know, it was just absolutely a forceful, powerful, simple, direct, and unmistakable argument for women's rights. And, you know, the reaction was incredible. We read, I think, 75 editorials in the days after. Only one was critical. The New York Times called it her finest hour of public service. And then, you know, when I traveled with her, I think, to, I don't know, 60-some countries as First Lady and then as Secretary of State. And, I mean, even years later, when she was Secretary of State, women around the world would run up to her clutching copies of that speech and chanting lines from it. And it became a kind of a – it just became – a document that that lifted women everywhere. It validated women. It gave voice to women who had no voice. It affirmed the rights of women in a way that literally no one in the history of the world ever had done. And so, for sure, it's, you know, the thing I'm most proud of having worked on with her.
As a speechwriter, what do you make of the current election between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump? Do you think the two candidates are, I mean, you know Secretary Clinton personally, but do you think Donald Trump is someone who should rely more on speeches, scripted speeches?
Well, you know, it's always a tough call because the person has to feel natural. And I think, you know, he obviously is very comfortable without using a text. And I, you know, as much as I hate to say this, he's actually pretty good. I mean, he's very conversational. He's very animated. He does a lot of things that, you know, go along with good speeches. So his problem is what he says, you know, which is just, you know, hideous and offensive and, you know, hateful and mean-spirited and false so much of the time. But his style is actually quite good. I do think the couple of times he's used a script, he's also, to my shock, done better than I would have expected reading off a teleprompter. And I think, you know, there's a lot more cogency and coherence to what he says, and it makes me a little nervous because I'm, you know, I kind of prefer him when he's just, you know, bouncing around from one thing to the next and has the potential to go, you know, off the rails, which he seems to do fairly regularly. You know, I think if he were comfortable with a script and he's comfortable with a teleprompter, it would probably be somewhat to his advantage. And I think his calculation is, you know, I've gotten as far as I've gotten by not doing that, by being different, by saying what I think, by being offensive if I feel like it, and why would I change? You know, that's a calculation he'll have to figure out for himself. In terms of Hillary, she, I think, you know, struggled for a while to find her voice in this campaign. It's always hard in a primary, and when, you know, an opponent who is very on message has sort of simpler answers that are very compelling, and that's sort of not her style. But I think as you see the campaign go on into the general election, she's going to find more coherence in her message, and I think that having Trump to run against has been great in the sense that the contrasts are just so extreme, and she's clearly enjoying pointing them out in a way that I'm, you know, I'm really happy about. And I think must be kind of, I mean, fun is not the right word, but certainly, you know, it's important and it feels really natural to her to go after him in the ways that she has been and to sort of unmask him for what he actually is.
What do you think is the best political speech of maybe all time or at least for a lifetime?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, and there's, gosh, I mean, that's just an impossible question because they're all, you know, they're sort of great in their own context. I mean, look, the Gettysburg Address, I always marvel at because 266 words long, you know, maybe 2 to 3 minute speech and said everything. So to be able to accomplish that much in that short a space with that kind of precision and concision to me is, you know, probably one of the greatest speeches ever. Of course, that was not in my lifetime. You know, I mean, I keep going back to Lincoln because I think his are among the greatest speeches. I just think he was probably the greatest presidential speechwriter there's ever been in his first inaugural. I just think is another extraordinary speech. I mean, you know, but you could look at Reagan's Challenger speech, which was brilliant and wonderful and just had an incredible compassion to it. You know, Barack Obama has given some great speeches. Bill Clinton gave some great, I mean, Bill Clinton's announcement of his campaign in 92, his acceptance of his nomination in 92 were wonderful speeches. But they're all, you know, they all serve different purposes. And so to sort of pick one and say, oh, my God, it's the greatest ever, I've always had a hard time doing that.
The final question that I always ask is, what advice would you give to someone who would want to go into the field that you are in today?
Well, it, you know, for young people who are interested in going into speech writing, my recommendation is usually the same. It's just to do a lot of writing. I happen to have no background in speech writing, and that was before speech writing was actually really even a kind of a bona fide profession. So, but what I did have was 15 years as a journalist writing on deadline and, you know, having to distill a lot of information quickly and accurately in a compelling way. So, that turned out to be extremely good training for me. And if you look at presidential speechwriters, they've come from all different kinds of backgrounds. Now, people are going into speech writing as a profession. There are speech writing firms. There are obviously more and more people in the corporate world and even in government at different levels, at lower levels. There's a million people writing speeches for, you know, assistant secretaries of energy or, you know, public affairs official at such and such of an agency or a state, you know, wide campaign or a congressional campaign. And so I think the key is really to pick an avenue that is most, sounds like it would be the most fun and the most interesting. And then just write. Just get really, really good at writing. And, you know, and then obviously you have to try to have a bond with the person you're writing for and respect them. But if you don't have the writing, you're not going to get that far.
Lisa Muscatine, it was a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
Thanks, David. Such a pleasure to talk to you. Take good care.